understanding of what he did, given that his actions, discussing ending U.S. sanctions on Russia with the Russian ambassador and then lying to the FBI about doing so, have already been widely reported. New, however, is the information in the Flynn plea affidavit that when he called K.T. McFarland at Mar-a-Lago to ask for advice on how to conduct his negotiations with Kislyak, McFarland was with other senior members of the presidential transition team. Given this, it would have been difficult for McFarland not to share the content of her phone call with Flynn with her superiors on the transition. That McFarland communicated to Flynn during at least one of their calls that the presidential transition team at Mar-a-Lago did not want Russia to escalate the situation regarding sanctions suggests that McFarland was passing on information from her superiors to Flynn. Also difficult to do if the superiors were not aware that Flynn was both on the phone and asking for guidance from above him in the chain of command, rather than from his deputy, McFarland. The affidavit also establishes that Flynn didn't discuss just Obama's sanctions with Kislyak, but also the incoming administration's foreign policy goals writ large, which, as would later be reported by Yahoo News in June 2017, included secret efforts to ease Russia sanctions upon Trump taking office. The affidavit also notes that when Flynn's course of negotiations was complete, he spoke with not just one, but multiple senior members of the presidential transition team to brief them on Russia's decision not to retaliate against the United States for Obama's imposition of new sanctions. It is unclear whether Flynn merely told these senior officials of the outcome of his conversations, or also what he had said to Kislyak during those conversations to achieve that outcome. Finally, Flynn's plea deal establishes that Kushner asked him to find out various nations' position on a UN resolution related to Israeli settlements. Mueller's court filings assert that Flynn did more than merely ask countries' representatives for their position on the resolution, but also requested that the nations he spoke to vote a certain way on it. The affidavit gives no indication of whether all of Flynn's actions were sanctioned by Kushner. Papadopoulos's late October plea documents are rather more detailed and revealing than Flynn's. They establish, as discussed here in previous chapters, that Papadopoulos was in touch with top officials on the Trump campaign to keep them perpetually apprised of his progress in negotiating with several Kremlin agents a Trump-Putin summit. The affidavit also establishes that Papadopoulos tried to destroy evidence that would have confirmed his Russian ties. In February 2017, he shut down a Facebook account that, when searched by the FBI, revealed communications with Russian nationals and other foreign contacts. The affidavit does not say which other countries' nationals Papadopoulos was in contact with, though separate reporting suggests, at a minimum, Israel, Greece, and Egypt as likely answers to that question. See chapters 5, 6, and 7. The affidavit does not establish which Trump campaign officials Papadopoulos told about the Russians having thousands of Clinton emails, but it does contend that his claim that he never told anyone on the campaign what Mifsud had told him about Clinton dirt was a false statement. The affidavit further indicates that Papadopoulos had an extensive talk with Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Ivan Timofeyev, and that the result of this talk was Papadopoulos learning that the Russians were indeed open to cooperation. Papadopoulos also revealed to Timofeyev that a meeting between top Trump campaign officials and Russian government officials, members of President Putin's office, had been approved on the Trump side, and that the purpose of such a meeting would be a day of consultations. The Papadopoulos affidavit states that on April 11, 2016, Papadopoulos received an email from Olga Polinskaya, née Vinogradova, offering, as she eventually makes clear on behalf of both her contacts at the Russian embassy in London and the Russian Federation as a whole, to support your initiatives between our two countries. Finally, the affidavit confirms that Papadopoulos wanted Russian government officials to see his late September 2016 interview with Russian media outlet Interfax. In that interview, Papadopoulos stated that Trump opposed all sanctions on Russia. The most explosive Trump-Russia testimonies of 2017 are those of Carter Page, Eric Prince, and Donald Trump Jr. The most startling revelation from the last of these is Trump Jr.'s September 2017 concession that he cannot recall whether he told his father about the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting at the time it was happening, a question he has answered in the negative on other occasions. As USA Today notes, interviews with the Senate Judiciary Committee could not answer the question of whether Trump Jr. told his father about the June 2016 meeting, as Trump Jr. said he couldn't remember whether he talked to his father about it. Rolling Stone offers a longer account of this critical segment of Trump Jr.'s testimony. The biggest question hanging over the June 9th meeting is whether Donald Trump had any knowledge of it. As the testimony lays out, after being contacted by Goldstone, Trump Jr. received a call from Emin Agalarov to discuss the meeting. Following the call, Trump Jr. placed a call to a blocked number, and, after that call concluded, dialed Agalarov back. Speculation has swirled that Trump was on the other end of the unknown call, and Trump Jr.'s amnesia-ridden testimony doesn't exactly quash suspicion that Trump knew of the meeting. When asked who he called between the two calls with Agalarov, Trump Jr. replied, "I have no idea." Corey Lewandowski testified separately that Trump's primary residence uses a blocked number, but Trump Jr., who one would assume would also possess this information, didn't seem so sure. When asked if his father uses a blocked number on his cell phone or on any phones that you call him on, Trump Jr. replied, "I don't know." When asked to clarify that he doesn't know if the call to the blocked number was to his father, Trump Jr. replied, "I don't." In January 2018, Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee will demand that Trump Jr.'s three transcribed testimonies from 2017 be turned over to Special Counsel Mueller on the argument that President Donald Trump's oldest son made false statements to the members of the committee, a federal crime. Eric Prince will face similar allegations after his November 2017 testimony before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, with one crucial difference. Media reports will indicate that Special Counsel Mueller already has evidence to confirm that Prince lied to Congress. According to a breaking news report on April 6, 2018 by ABC News, Special Counsel Robert Mueller has obtained evidence that calls into question congressional testimony given by Trump supporter and Blackwater founder Eric Prince last year, when he described a meeting in Seychelles with a Russian financier close to Vladimir Putin as a casual chance encounter over a beer. Well-connected Lebanese-American businessman George Nader, a key witness given limited immunity by Mueller, has been interviewed seven times by prosecutors on a wide range of subjects. He told investigators that he set up a meeting in the Seychelles between Prince and Russian sovereign wealth fund CEO Kirill Dmitriev mere days before Trump was inaugurated. Documents obtained by Mueller suggest that before and after Prince met Nader in New York, a week before the trip to the Seychelles, Nader shared information with Prince about Dmitriev, which appears to be inconsistent with Prince's sworn testimony before a U.S. House of Representatives investigative panel. "I didn't fly there to meet any Russian guy," Prince told the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence in November. He testified that he traveled to the Seychelles for a meeting with United Arab Emirates officials about possible business opportunities, and they introduced him, unexpectedly, to Dmitriev. Prince will make a number of statements on equally significant topics, such as whether he ever had formal communications or contact with the Trump campaign in 2016, that likewise will come under scrutiny as possible perjuries. For instance, Prince's claim to have had no formal communication or contact with Trump's campaign is contradicted by revelations about an August 3, 2016 Trump Tower meeting Prince set up between himself, Donald Trump Jr., George Nader, and Joel Zammel. In November 2017, Mueller interviews Stephen Miller, called by CNN the highest-level aide still working at the White House known to have talked to investigators. According to CNN, Miller can speak not only to Trump's thinking as he decided whether and when to fire James Comey, but also to a March 2016 meeting where foreign policy adviser George Papadopoulos said that he could arrange a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin through his connections. It is unclear whether this is the March 31, 2016 meeting Trump held with his entire National Security Advisory Committee or a smaller meeting between Trump, Papadopoulos, and Miller. Miller is known to be one of the first Trump campaign aides Papadopoulos told of his contact with Mifsud, see Chapter 5, and he authored an early draft of Trump's letter firing Comey. The New York Times reports that White House counsel Don McGahn blocked the letter because of its angry, meandering tone. Perhaps the most problematic event of the latter half of 2017 comes at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, where Trump not only meets with Putin multiple times and for longer than scheduled each time, but also manages to hold his talks with the Russian president without a full complement of witnesses and note-takers present. Only Putin friend Rex Tillerson, Sergei Lavrov, and two interpreters are allowed to attend. At one of the G20's several joint meals, Trump orchestrates a second meeting with Putin that is disclosed to the media only when leaked to the press by a concerned summit attendee. Annotated History. In January 2018, Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee will demand that Trump Jr.'s three transcribed testimonies from 2017 be turned over to Special Counsel Mueller on argument that President Donald Trump's oldest son made false statements to members of the committee, a federal crime. On September 7, 2017, Donald Trump Jr. testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He maintained that he did not collude with any foreign government, a statement covering, therefore, not just Russia, but Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Israel, Turkey, Hungary, and other governments known to have reached out to the Trump campaign pre-election, and also that he did not know of anyone who did. The focus of Trump Jr.'s testimony was his June 9, 2016 meeting with several Russian nationals at Trump Tower. A few minutes after being told that, although this interview is not under oath, by law you are required to answer questions truthfully, Trump Jr. said, "I don't remember much from the meeting because I didn't give it much credence." He did remember, however, that the Russians told him, U.S. or Russian-based business people who were supporters of the DNC and perhaps Hillary Clinton were in some sort of tax scheme to avoid paying taxes in both the United States and Russia. The second time he described Veselnitskaya's narrative to the committee, he was even clearer. People who had some connections or dealings in Russia and the United States, who were big funders of the DNC and or Hillary Clinton, were perhaps avoiding paying taxes in both of those markets through some sort of scheme. He added, "It didn't really seem all that relevant to me." Noteworthy here is that on the day of the meeting, Trump Jr.'s father was just 96 hours from a planned speech on a single subject: misconduct by the Clintons and those connected to the Clintons. Asked about what Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, and Kushner, one of Trump's top advisors, were doing during the 20 minutes, maybe 30, of the meeting, Trump Jr. replied that both were on their phones, the implication being that neither man was particularly interested in the meeting. Though Trump Jr. told investors at a Manhattan conference in 2008 that he'd made half a dozen trips to Russia in the last 18 months, March 2007 to September 2008, Trump Jr. testified before Congress that he'd been to Russia only four or five times over the course of his life. He said there were no discussions about real estate projects between Trump and the Agalarovs at the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in November 2013, as it was only following the pageant that the parties began preliminarily discussing the topic. He added that the Trump Organization has not made investments in Russia ever. Though Paul Manafort had taken over the day-to-day operations of the Trump campaign from Corey Lewandowski by mid-April 2016, Trump Jr. claimed that, as of June 2016, we were in the process of replacing our campaign manager, Lewandowski. It was an extraordinarily intense period of time, a maelstrom. Despite having told Goldstone, "I love it," in response to his offer of Clinton incriminating official documents and information, Trump Jr. told Congress that his first reaction to Goldstone's offer was a skeptical one. He said that Kushner and Manafort attended the meeting with no idea what it was about or who would attend and were invited on a moment's notice. He added that he had told no one else about the meeting. With respect to the information that Kremlin agent Natalia Veselnitskaya provided to him, Kushner, and Manafort, he said that it was very general and difficult to understand. Moreover, he said it had no point because, as a private citizen, no one on the campaign could negotiate foreign policy. Trump Jr. returned to this same detail several times, at one moment saying to his questioners, "We made the Russians aware that we," he himself, Kushner, and Manafort, "were private citizens. This isn't something we're doing about adoption." He added that the Magnitsky Act sanctions were not a campaign issue and weren't going to be a campaign issue, wasn't something we were talking about in the campaign. Trump Jr. said that after the meeting was over, he never spoke of it again to anyone. He insisted that he had no information whatsoever as of June 3, 2016, the day Rob Goldstone emailed him about setting up a meeting at Trump Tower, that the Russian government supported then-candidate Trump. As to the phone calals and emails of June 6, 2016, just 3 days before the meeting, Trump Jr. told the Senate Judiciary Committee that he couldn't remember whether he received a call from Emin after Rob Goldstone emailed him to say Emin was about to call. Indeed, he couldn't remember any call he had made or received that day. He said it was possible that, after the Miss Universe pageant, he went back and forth by phone or email with Emin Agalarov because we were looking at a potential deal in Moscow. We've met face-to-face on 2 or 3 occasions, and we looked at doing a deal once. Tellingly, when asked about whether Emin Agalarov has ties to the Russian government, Trump responded that he knew of no specific ties. When asked on follow-up if there were any general ties Trump Jr. was aware of, he responded that there were no official ties. When then asked, as part of a further follow-up, if there were any ties at all between Emin and the Russian government, Trump Jr. responded simply, "I would only speculate." Asked if, on June 9, 2016, anyone offered to release hacked emails to aid the Trump campaign, Trump Jr. said no. However, June 9, 2016, the very day the Russian government had promised the Trump campaign through the Agalarovs it would hand over Clinton dirt, was the first full day of the website and social media operation for DC Leaks, a Russian entity whose sole purpose was to release hacked emails to aid the Trump campaign, per the congressional record. Asked if, on June 9, 2016, anyone offered to manufacture and distribute fake news to aid the Trump campaign, Trump Jr. responded no. He did not note his August 3, 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Joel Zammel, at which Zammel did exactly what Trump Jr. had just been asked about. Offered to manufacture and distribute fake news to aid the Trump campaign. Nor did he note that after the election, Zammel's Psy Group formed a partnership with Cambridge Analytica. Asked if there was any discussion of anything that might reasonably be considered collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, Trump Jr. said no. Yet he later revealed in the same testimony that within minutes of being offered detrimental information about Clinton by Veselnitskaya, he told her that Trump would take another look at the Magnitsky Act if he were elected president. Trump Jr. claimed he had no recollection of Rinat Akhmetshin being at the meeting. Akhmetshin has been called by the New York Times a man with deep ties to the Russian government and Kremlin-backed oligarchs, and an association with a former deputy head of a Russian spy service, the FSB, and a history of working for close allies of Vladimir V. Putin. Akhmetshin was indeed at the meeting, as he has confirmed. Trump Jr. summarized his feelings about the meeting by saying that it was immediately pretty apparent that this meeting wasn't going anywhere, and we were all looking to get back to our daily lives. On the crucial question of whether he spoke to his father by telephone about the meeting before it happened, Trump Jr. had amnesia, not just for any calls he made that week to his father or to Emin Agalarov, but even on the subject of whether his father, whom he indicated he spoke with daily, used a phone number that came up blocked on Trump Jr.'s phone. The rest of Trump Jr.'s testimony revealed many additional issues that could, as the committee Democrats subsequently noted, open Trump Jr. up to legal liability. Prince will make a number of statements on equally significant topics, such as whether he ever had formal communication or contact with the Trump campaign in 2016, that likewise will come under scrutiny as possible perjuries. Much of Eric Prince's testimony appeared at first blush to be false. He told the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, for instance, that he played no official or unofficial role in Trump's bid for the presidency, that Steve Bannon was the only guy in the campaign I knew pretty well, that when he met Kirill Dmitriev, he had no idea Dmitriev ran the Russian government's direct investment fund, and that he was in no way representing the Trump campaign in meeting with Dmitriev. Prince even claimed not to have received the committee's pre-testimony letter requesting documents from him. According to the committee, the letter had been sent to him on a bipartisan basis by certified mail, electronic mail, and facsimile. Later, Prince said that he had received from the Senate the same sort of letter he said that he had not received from the House. The only known difference between the two entreaties was that Prince had met beforehand with Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Indeed, Prince revealed that he had had multiple private meetings with either Nunes or his staff prior to his testimony before Nunes's committee, a notable fact given that Prince was active in assisting the Trump team during the transition, Nunes was a member of Trump's transition team, and many of the allegations of improper conduct that were raised during Prince's testimony arose from events that allegedly occurred during the transition. Prince's answers at times changed in midstream. After telling Congressman Schiff under oath that he didn't recall specifically speaking to anyone about a meeting that happened during the transition with any Emirati officials in New York, additional questioning forced a concession. I think I remember Steve Bannon saying they, members of the transition team, had met with Mohammed bin Zayed, and that he was a great guy. Pressed further, he admitted that Bannon characterized the meeting for him, in addition to complimenting bin Zayed. Likewise, in August 2016, Prince set up a meeting between an emissary of the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates, George Nader, and the Trump campaign, yet told Congress that not one of the policy papers he gave to Bannon had anything to do with the UAE. He also admitted to Congress having multiple interactions with Michael Flynn in 2015 and 2016, including at least one face-to-face interaction. The UAE was at the time central to the lobbying work on nuclear energy that Flynn was engaged in with Thomas Barrack, Bud McFarlane, Rick Gates, and others. Prince also said he had spoken with Bannon about Russia during the transition. At the time, a significant issue before the Trump team was whether Russian construction firms would be able to get contracts for nuclear reactor construction projects in the Middle East, including in the UAE. See Chapter 11. Prince's description of his meeting with Dmitriev likewise strained credulity. He indicated that the meeting was a by-the-way afterthought at the end of his meetings with the Emiratis and Mohammed bin Zayed. Prince said the Emiratis indicated he should meet with Dmitriev only if he wanted to, and that the only reason to do so was because Prince happened to be in the Seychelles. Prince used the phrase, "while you're here," multiple times to describe the Emirati's passive endorsement of a Prince-Dmitriev meeting. Minutes before the meeting, Prince said he Googled Dmitriev to try to find out something about him and could discover only that he was a Russian hedge fund manager. Mueller's information is that Nader had fully briefed Prince on Dmitriev even before Prince flew to the Seychelles. According to ABC News, Nader told prosecutors that he set up a meeting in the Seychelles between Prince and Dmitriev just days before Trump was inaugurated. In short, if Nader's account is true, it means that almost nothing Eric Prince told Congress in November 2017 was. Chapter 14. A Nation in Suspense. 2018. Summary. In the second year of Trump's presidency, the Trump-Russia scandal explodes, extending out in so many different directions simultaneously, it is difficult to track them all, especially as all but one congressional investigation goes dark, and Special Counsel Mueller begins collecting cooperating witnesses from Trump's orbit through ancillary indictments rather than Russia-related ones. As other scandals not directly related to Trump-Russia collusion begin to rock the Trump administration, from the resignations of cabinet secretaries to illicit hush money payoffs to ex-mistresses, from a bungled North Korea summit to the president's ongoing attacks on dying war hero John McCain, tracing the shape of the Trump-Russia investigation becomes more a matter of identifying nodes of activity than charting a single through line. This is made especially difficult by the increasing number of seeming wrong turns or dead ends, leads that appear to promise the exposure of critical components of the Trump-Russia quid pro quo, only to remain frustratingly unresolved. Ultimately, the innumerable narrative tendrils of the Trump-Russia affair become so varied in their contours and trajectory in 2018 that the current state of the Trump-Russia investigation, inasmuch as it is visible to the public, can be described only as one of perpetual suspense. Trump's increasingly mercurial behavior characterizes the second year of near-daily controversy in the White House. He floats pardons for both convicted associates and those under investigation. He remains in secretive contact with potential witnesses against him, raising concerns about possible witness tampering. He works both behind the scenes and publicly on his Twitter feed to see punished, demoted, fired, or otherwise disgraced any member of the law enforcement or intelligence community investigating him or his aides, allies, and associates. He maneuvers himself into a position to fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, Special Counsel Robert Mueller, or all three, darkly intimating his intention to do so in daily tweets and statements to the media. He uses Twitter as a weapon, alleging wild deep state conspiracies against him at the highest levels of his own government. He plays a public relations game with his self-proclaimed but perpetually elusive willingness to cooperate with investigators. He issues declarations of innocence that become propaganda in Russia almost instantaneously. "From the United States, we hear there was not any Russian meddling in the elections," says Putin's right-hand man and Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov in August 2018, referring to statements made by the President of the United States. In all, the state of not only the Trump presidency but the Union itself comes to seem in doubt in 2018, with the path back to normalcy and good order in government for either law enforcement, Congress, or concerned Americans treacherous at best, and perhaps even impassable. The facts. In July 2017, Congress bucks years of ever-increasing partisan rancor to agree almost unanimously on a single subject: the need to punish the Russian government for its interference in the 2016 presidential elections. The result is CATSA, Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, which passes through both houses of Congress with a total vote of 517-5. The bill mandates that the White House submit for congressional approval any proposal to terminate or waive Russian sanctions, that current sanctions against Russia be maintained, and that the executive branch identify new targets for sanctions in 10 sectors of Russian activity. Trump signs CATSA in August 2017, yet declares that the bill is seriously flawed and encroaches on the executive branch's authority to negotiate with the Kremlin. When the October 2017 deadline for the White House to identify new sanction targets arrives, the White House ignores it. Indeed, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, an old friend of Putin's, according to Vanity Fair, has shut down the State Department office that oversees sanctions. At the very end of November, the White House finally issues a preliminary list of new targets upon whom sanctions will be leveled in January. In January 2018, the Trump administration grudgingly meets CATSA's six-month deadline for new sanctions to be announced, identifying 21 new persons and 9 new companies to be sanctioned, but announces that it will go no further, reasoning that the threat of sanctions is already acting as a deterrent against continued Russian cyber attacks on the United States, and that Russia's defense industry is already suffering to a sufficient degree under the existing sanctions. While the White House does release, consistent with CATSA's reporting requirements, an unclassified list of 114 senior Russian politicians and 96 business people considered Russian oligarchs, it does not impose any penalties on them. Trump's hostility to legally mandated sanctions after signing off on a new round is not the only mixed signal coming out of his administration. Mike Pompeo, Trump's hand-picked CIA director, declares in January that he fully expects the Russians to interfere in the midterm elections, even though the administration has soft-pedaled the CATSA sanctions on the grounds that they cannot deter Russian cyber aggression any more than current U.S. countermeasures are. Less than 72 hours later, news breaks that Pompeo has secretly met with the chief officers of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Agency and Internal Security Agency, both men barred from entering the United States under the sanctions imposed on Russia in 2014. Pompeo is said to have followed a multi-agency legal process to get the two Russian intelligence officers into the United States. Meanwhile, Mueller continues his interrogations of key figures in the Trump-Russia case. In January, he strikes an agreement with former Trump campaign CEO Steve Bannon to interview him out of court rather than subpoena him to appear before a grand jury. Around the same time, Jeff Sessions becomes the 15th member of the Trump administration to be interviewed by Mueller. The Attorney General's voluntary interview lasts several hours, according to confirmation by the Justice Department. In March, investigators from Mueller's team question Trump National Security Advisor Eric Prince and subsequently seize his phones and a computer. Media reports note that one of Mueller's many possible areas of inquiry for Prince is the means by which Prince's January 2017 meeting in the Seychelles was arranged. While Prince claims it was merely a fortuitous event, other reporting, most notably from the Washington Post, suggests otherwise. The United Arab Emirates arranged a secret meeting in January between Blackwater founder Eric Prince and a Russian close to President Vladimir Putin as part of an apparent effort to establish a back-channel line of communication between Moscow and President-elect Donald Trump, according to U.S., European, and Arab officials. The UAE agreed to broker the meeting in part to explore whether Russia could be persuaded to curtail its relationship with Iran, including in Syria, a Trump administration objective that would be likely to require major concessions to Moscow on U.S. sanctions. Though Prince had no formal role with the Trump campaign or transition team, he presented himself as an unofficial envoy for Trump. In his November 2017 testimony before Congress, Prince had grudgingly admitted to being told of a single meeting involving Steve Bannon and the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, but according to the Post, there were multiple such discussions. They also involved Michael Flynn and Jared Kushner, and the Crown Prince decided to assist the Trump transition team in setting up a back channel to Putin only after meeting twice with Putin in 2016 and urging the Russian leader to work more closely with the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, an effort to isolate Iran. In April, Special Counsel Mueller asks Dana Bente, the FBI's general counsel, to testify before the Trump-Russia grand jury. The request is significant because Bente is one of Comey's corroborating witnesses, fellow FBI officials to whom Comey related his conversations with Trump shortly after they were completed and who kept their own contemporaneous notes. While Trump has successfully cast doubt on Comey and his deputy Andrew McCabe, another Comey confidant, in the minds of many Republicans in Washington, Bente remains undiscussed and untouched by Trump and his allies thus far. Bente's testimony also underscores that Mueller is considering obstruction of justice charges in the Trump-Russia affair, if brought against Trump, an impeachable offense, and not merely Trump-Russia collusion, which would, in the first instance, be charged as aiding and abetting or conspiracy. In June, Mueller's team questions Ukrainian politician Andriy V. Artemenko for several hours before a grand jury. Artemenko will later say that most of the questions were focused on Michael Cohen, confirming that Mueller retains significant interest in Trump's personal attorney and fixer on the Russia collusion question, even as federal prosecutors in Manhattan are investigating Cohen for white-collar financial crimes. This interest is confirmed when it is revealed that Mueller's agents have also detained and questioned Viktor Vekselberg, the Russian oligarch who paid Cohen hundreds of thousands of dollars in alleged consulting fees, at a New York airport. In August, prosecutors in the Southern District of New York grant immunity to Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. While the grant is a limited one that is allegedly focused on the ongoing investigation of Michael Cohen, the deal with Weisselberg raises the specter of Mueller sometime soon piercing the Trump Organization's corporate veil to get information on Trump's own financial dealings and tax returns. According to CNN, Weisselberg is so much more than the Trump Organization's CFO. Hired first by Trump's father, Weisselberg has been the money man in Trump's orbit for decades, and he didn't just handle finances for the Trump Organization, but also for Trump's personal accounts. According to Bloomberg, nobody knows the Trump Organization like Alan Weisselberg. The Atlantic, writing on the grant of immunity to Weisselberg, concluded that New York prosecutors may pose a bigger threat to Trump than Mueller. Mueller's relationship with New York prosecutors is procedurally a two-way street, however. Just as Mueller can, in August, refer three individuals for prosecution by the Southern District of New York for failing to register as foreign lobbyists, the Southern District is presumed to be willing to share with Mueller any information from its own investigations. Slate will even speculate that Mueller's intention in spreading his work around to other prosecutors is to hedge his bets against his own eventual firing, making the investigation of Trump's business dealings impossible to derail even if Jeff Sessions, Rod Rosenstein, and Mueller himself are all fired by the president. In late February, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence interviews Hope Hicks in a closed session. Hicks reportedly refuses to answer any questions about events post-inauguration, while admitting she may have lied for Trump on occasion, although she insists none of the lies were substantive. The next day, she announces that she will be resigning her position at the White House. Within 12 days, the committee has ended its investigation. It will later issue a report, endorsed only by its Republican members, concluding that there was no collusion whatsoever between the Trump campaign and Russia. In March, federal agents detained self-described Trump advisor Ted Malik, also a known associate of Roger Stone's, and seize his cell phone. Their subsequent questioning of him focuses on Stone, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Nigel Farage, and Malik's repeated contacts with both Stone and the Trump campaign in 2016. Throughout 2018, Mueller proceeds expeditiously with his work, periodically issuing indictments that rock America's political ecosystem before returning to the necessary secrecy and opacity of his ongoing investigation. While some of the major advancements in Mueller's federal criminal probe are attributable to charges brought by Mueller and his D.C. team, others are the result of Mueller's referrals to federal prosecutors elsewhere. Into this latter category falls one particularly critical set of Trump-related convictions. 8 convictions for Trump's former personal attorney Michael Cohen for offenses including tax fraud, bank fraud, causing an unlawful corporate contribution, and making an excessive campaign contribution. While there is no direct link between these convictions and the Trump-Russia case, other than them comprising additional evidence that Trump is easily blackmailed, a perpetual concern if Putin holds compromat on him, they do directly implicate Trump in a crime for the first time since he has taken office. At his in-court allocution, Cohen unambiguously identifies Trump, using a euphemistic appellation required by Department of Justice protocols, as the man who directed him to commit a number of his crimes. Because the prevailing wisdom in the Department of Justice and the legal community more broadly is that a sitting president cannot be indicted, or, if indicted, cannot be tried in a criminal court, Cohen's accusation does not lead to immediate legal jeopardy for Trump. But it adds evidence of criminality to any future impeachment proceedings and, perhaps as important, puts Cohen at the mercy of special counsel Mueller. Cohen's plea deal in Manhattan all but ensures he will spend at least 4 or 5 years in prison. But cooperation with Mueller could potentially shorten that sentence, or any sentence Mueller might seek on collusion-related conspiracy charges down the line, though at the time of Cohen's plea, all parties agree no such deal yet exists. Cohen faces additional legal liability for his clandestine negotiations with Russian nationals during the campaign, for ferrying a policy proposal by a foreign power to the White House, which would violate the Logan Act, and for possibly selling access to Trump prior to Trump's inauguration. He was also paid $400,000 by Ukrainian nationals to set up a back channel between Trump and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko in June 2017, according to the BBC. The timing of the payment is significant because shortly afterward, the Ukrainian government halted its domestic criminal investigations of Paul Manafort. Another case Mueller hands off to other prosecutors that likewise could, in time, become significant to the Trump-Russia investigation is Maria Butina's indictment in the District of Columbia in July for conspiracy to act as an agent of a foreign government and failing to register as a foreign agent. While the very fact of Butina's arrest and the continued freedom of her boyfriend Paul Erickson suggests that Erickson may be a cooperating witness in the case against her, her youth, vulnerability as a Russian national caught in a nation not her own, and apparently substantial knowledge of Russian intelligence activities and capabilities within the United States suggests she too could be susceptible to a cooperation agreement. Certainly the information Mueller appends to her indictments suggests that she has substantial knowledge to offer Mueller on the subject of illicit Russian activities from the same period of time the Trump-Russia investigation is focused upon, 2012 to 2016. Of course, Mueller also remains busy in 2018, continuing his prosecution of Trump associates while adding to his prosecutorial brief new charges against Russian nationals directly involved in Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. In February, he indicts 13 Russian nationals and 3 Russian organizations on charges of conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud, and 6 counts of aggravated identity theft. Because the special counsel uses what is called a speaking indictment, an indictment that not only lays out charges but discusses in some detail the inculpatory facts undergirding them, his indictment of participants in Russia's Internet Research Agency gives Americans their first look at the Russian propaganda operation from the inside. What Americans learn is that Russia's election influence and interference campaign began in May 2014, approximately 6 months after Trump returned from his November 2013 Miss Universe Moscow trip. Putin's anger over the American response to his 2014 annexation of Crimea is more likely to have prompted his initiation of such a complex, hostile, and geopolitically dangerous operation in May 2014 than Trump's still incipient presidential campaign, but it is nevertheless clear, given Trump's December 2013 conversations with New York politicians and Trump aide Sam Nunberg's observations of when Trump decided to run for president, that for those in the know, particularly those in personal or business partnerships with Trump, his plans for 2016 were evident in late 2013. Mueller's indictment of the Internet Research Agency and a number of its participants also establishes that several Russian nationals traveled to the United States to conduct reconnaissance before the operation began, raising the possibility that they were in contact with American political operatives during their travels. As NPR notes, Mueller's indictment does confirm that Trump campaign workers corresponded with Russian influence mongers who even paid some Americans to show up for protests they organized, but none of the Americans knew they were dealing with Russian operatives, despite their actions offering important help to the Russian operation. Russian interactions with unwitting Republican political operatives even aided the Russians in determining which states to target their activities toward for maximum impact during the 2016 election cycle. While both Mueller and his Russian defendants are aware the case will never be prosecuted, the DOJ and FBI have no expectation the Kremlin will extradite the men and women charged, the indictment does have the unanticipated side effect of briefly forcing Trump to acknowledge Russian malfeasance. On February 16, 2018, Trump tweets, "Russia started their anti-U.S. campaign in 2014, long before I announced that I would run for president. The results of the election were not impacted. The Trump campaign did nothing wrong. No collusion." Trump's erroneous statement of when information about his anticipated 2016 presidential run became common knowledge in select political and corporate circles aside, his reference to an anti-U.S. campaign by Russia will be one of the only times he ever recognizes Russian criminality during the 2016 election as a certainty rather than one possible scenario among many. In July 2018, Mueller charges 12 spies from Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU, as key culprits behind the Russian hacking operation that attacked America's electoral infrastructure in 2015 and 2016. The GRU, the same Russian outfit with which Michael Flynn was unusually enamored in 2013 and 2014, is accused by Mueller, per Vox, of hacking the computer networks of members of Hillary Clinton's campaign, the Democratic National Committee, and the Democratic Congressional Committee, and coordinating to release damaging information to sway the election under the names DC Leaks and Guccifer 2.0. The former of these two entities, a website, had its first full day of operation on June 9, 2016, the very day the Kremlin promised to give the Trump campaign materials damaging to Clinton, while the latter, a persona, was in contact with Trump advisor Roger Stone on more than one occasion. Mueller's indictment is silent on whether the actions of these GRU spies affected the outcome of the 2016 election, And indeed, it takes the same non-position on that question that Mueller's February indictments did. But in mid-July, Trump will nevertheless tweet that the special counsel's investigation is intended as merely a Democrat excuse for losing the 2016 election. In all, Mueller's July indictment charges 11 Russians with conspiracy to commit computer crimes, 8 counts of aggravated identity theft, and conspiracy to launder money, while 2 defendants are charged with a separate count of conspiracy to commit computer crimes. In between these 2 sets of indictments, the first person to serve time as a result of the Trump-Russia investigation, Belgian-born lawyer Alex van der Zwaan, reports to prison for a 30-day sentence. Van der Zwaan had, according to his plea deal, lied to Mueller's team in November 2017 about his phone calls and emails with Trump deputy campaign manager and later Trump RNC liaison, Rick Gates. Special Counsel Mueller will announce in March 2018 that Gates had repeated contacts during the final weeks of the 2016 presidential race with a business associate tied to Russian intelligence, a person the FBI believes had active links to Russian spy services at the time. Gates told an associate the person was a former Russian intelligence officer with the GRU, the Russian intelligence agency. After his February 2018 plea to one count of making false statements, Alex van der Zwaan begins serving his prison time in April. The case is considered significant not because someone closely connected to a top Trump associate is imprisoned or because the lies van der Zwaan told and evidence he destroyed stemmed from Gates's and Manafort's actions in Ukraine in the aughts, but because van der Zwaan told a knowing lie during an investigation of international importance, according to Judge Amy Berman Jackson, and hence deserved his sentence. The facts already publicly known in the Trump-Russia investigation suggest that before Mueller's investigation is complete, a similar allegation may be leveled at several Americans in Trump's immediate orbit. In August 2018, Paul Manafort is convicted of 8 federal felonies, including 5 counts of tax fraud, 2 counts of bank fraud, and 1 count of failure to disclose a foreign bank account. The jury hangs, 11-1 for conviction, on 10 additional charges. While the trial does not directly implicate Trump's 2016 campaign, the facts revealed during the course of the prosecution's case in chief underscore that Manafort had no intention of being Trump's campaign manager for free. Instead, he was deeply in debt and hoping to use his work for Trump as a means of settling his debts with Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska. The trial thereby establishes a motive for collusion for the man running Trump's presidential campaign from early April to mid-August 2016. Moreover, it gives Mueller enough leverage over Manafort to get Manafort's cooperation in prosecuting other defendants in the Trump-Russia investigation, despite Trump's dangling of a presidential pardon for Manafort in the press. As an op-ed in the New York Times will note after Manafort's trial, by speculating about a Trump pardon of Manafort, the president and his surrogates have already acted improperly. Later in August, W. Samuel Patton, an associate of Paul Manafort's longtime Russian business partner Konstantin Kilimnik, pleads guilty to acting as an unregistered foreign lobbyist, admits to lying to Congress, and acknowledges facilitating the transfer of money from a Ukrainian oligarch to Trump's inaugural fund. The case brings into even greater relief a growing controversy surrounding the tens of millions of dollars missing from the inaugural fund. $26 million of the more than $100 million raised for Trump's inauguration was paid to a firm run by Melania Trump's top advisor, and a significant percentage of that $26 million went to a team run by Mark Burnett, creator of the program that made Trump a television celebrity, The Apprentice. According to the New York Times, Trump personally requested Burnett's involvement with the inaugural festivities, a significant fact given that multiple Trump associates have alleged that Burnett is still today protecting Trump from the disclosure of Apprentice outtakes in which Trump can be heard uttering misogynistic and racist slurs. Should Mueller's investigation extend to possible corruption in the form of bribery or money laundering in the inaugural activities coordinated by Trump friend Thomas Barrack, who was lobbying Trump on Middle Eastern energy issues while managing the money for Trump's inauguration? It could open the door to a more robust public consideration of both Trump's pre-election payoffs to bury damaging information and his receipt of funds from foreign nationals during and after the 2016 presidential campaign. Whether it is these indictments and convictions that rile Trump or something else, 2018 sees the president expressing increasing desperation in his public remarks on the Trump-Russia case, calling it, or variously individual elements of it, rigged 44 times on Twitter between January and August 2018, a witch hunt 106 times, and illegal 24 times. In an April 2018 interview, former FBI Director James Comey implies that he perceives consciousness of guilt in certain of Trump's actions since allegations he and his team colluded with the Russian government became public. The Washington Post has been even more forceful, publishing an article by Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Eugene Robinson alleging that Trump seems to be staging a cover-up. Trump's actions in 2018 will do much to further this impression among his critics and others in law enforcement. His fury at his enemies and anxiety over the loyalty of his allies lead to an erratic course of conduct that sees Trump courting potential allies and persecuting perceived enemies throughout the year in ways that may eventually produce criminal liability for him or, in the short term, hurt him politically. When former CIA Director John Brennan becomes a vocal critic of Trump, calling Trump's claims that he did not collude with the Russians hogwash, Trump revokes his lifetime national security clearance, an act of vengeance against a political critic that is unprecedented in American politics. He threatens to do the same to several other officials who have disagreed with him publicly, including former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. As Brennan himself observes, writing in the New York Times in August, Trump began step by step from the moment 10 days into his administration that he fired the acting Attorney General Sally Q. Yates to oversee the removal of top national security officials who have defied him or worked at senior levels of the Russia investigation. They include James B. Comey, the former FBI director, Andrew G. McCabe, the former FBI deputy director, and Peter Strzok, the former FBI counterintelligence agent who helped oversee the Russia investigation. In February 2018, the FBI also loses David Laufman, whom the New York Times calls the top Justice Department official overseeing espionage investigations, as well as cases involving foreign lobbying and leaks of classified information, for personal reasons. His exit is deemed surprising. The fact that he is mentioned in controversial anti-Trump text messages sent by Peter Strzok to former FBI attorney Lisa Page and was in charge of aspects of the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election raises the possibility that he is another victim of the president's withering public critiques. Other significant personnel developments at the FBI and DOJ from April 2017 through 2018, all involving individuals connected in some way to the Russia investigation, include Lisa Page, who resigns in May 2018 after being accused of texting controversial messages about Trump to and receiving controversial messages about Trump from FBI agent Peter Strzok. James Baker, the FBI's general counsel, who is demoted in 2017 and then resigns in 2018 and is known to be a close friend and longtime associate of Trump enemy Comey. This fact leads to complaints, according to Business Insider, by national security experts and former intelligence officials who question the timing of Baker's departure and whether it was a politically motivated decision in response to pressure from President Donald Trump and his allies. James Rybicki, also a close associate of Comey, in fact, his former chief of staff, who quits the bureau in January 2018. Bill Priestap, the head of the FBI Counterintelligence Division and in a pivotal leadership position per The Hill in the Russia probe, who is called to testify before the House and remains under fire from conservatives throughout 2018, in part because of a trip to London in May 2018.